Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Warbreaker, Part 3. Created by Brandon Sanderson. Narrated by Dylan Lynch. With performances by Elizabeth Jernigan, Colleen Delaney, James Konacek, Tim Getman, Steve Carpenter, Ren Casey, David Coyne, Richard Rowan, Ken Jackson, Amanda Thickpenny, Lily Beacon, Scott McCormick, Mort Shelby, Christopher Graybill, James Lewis, Tony Penny, Nanette Savard, Eric Messner, and Terrence Azelford. Warbreaker, Part 3.
I will not leave you.
Susan Braun sat on the floor beside the bed, his back propped up by pillows.
I promise. How can you be sure?
Siri sat in her usual place on the bed.
Maybe once you have an heir, you'll grow tired of life and then give away your breath.
Mm-mm.
First of all, I'm still not even sure how I would get an heir. You refuse to explain it to me, nor will you answer my questions. They're embarrassing. Secondly, I cannot give away my breath, not if what I understand about biochroma is true. Do you think I've been lied to about how breaths work? He's getting much more articulate in his writing. It's such a shame that he's been locked up his entire life. I really don't know much about it. Biochroma isn't exactly something we focus on in Idris. I suspect that half of the things I know are rumors and exaggerations. For instance, back in Idris, they think you sacrifice people on altars in the court here. I heard that half a dozen times from different people. Regardless, we argue something that is absurd. I will not change. I am not going to suddenly decide to kill myself. You do not need to worry. Siri, I lived for 50 years with no information, no knowledge, barely able to communicate. Can you really think that I would kill myself now? Now, when I've discovered how to write, when I've discovered someone to talk to, when I've discovered you? All right, I believe you. But I still think we have to worry about your priests.
Susan Braun didn't respond, looking away.
Why is he so cursedly loyal to them?
Finally, he looked back at her.
Would you grow your hair? Oh, and what color am I to make it? Red. You Halandrins in your bright colors. Do you realize that my people consider red to be the most flagrant of all colors? I'm sorry. I did not mean to offend you. No, look, I wasn't arguing. I was just being flirtatious. I'm sorry. My storybook doesn't use this term. I know. That book is too full of stories about children getting eaten by trees and things. The stories are metaphors meant to teach. Yes, I know. So, what is flirtatious? It's... oh, colors, how do I get myself into these situations? It's when a girl acts hesitant or sometimes silly in order to make a man pay more attention to her. Why would that make a man pay attention to her? Well, like this. Do you want me to grow my hair? Yes. Do you really want me to? Of course. Well then... if I must...
Siri tossed her head, commanding her hair to become a deep auburn red. It flushed mid-toss, flaring from yellow to red like ink bleeding into a pool of clear water. Then she made it grow. Even as the hair whipped past her face, it grew in length. She tossed her head one final time, the hair making it feel more heavy, the neck warm from the locks which now tumbled down around her shoulders and down her back, twisting in loose curls. Susan Braun looked at her with wide eyes. She met them,
then tried a seductive glance. Siri fell back on the bed.
Oh, you are very strange. I know. I'm not meant to be a seductress. I can't keep a straight face. Seductress. I know that word. Oh, it's used in a story when the evil queen tries to tempt the young prince with something. Though I don't know what. I think she must have been planning to offer him food. Yeah, good interpretation there, Seb. Completely right. She wasn't offering food, was she? I feel like such an idiot. Oh, there's so much that everyone else understands intrinsically. Yet I have only the stories of children's books to guide me. I've read them so often that it's hard to separate myself and the way I view them from the child I was when I first read them.
Siri sat up, then laid a hand on his arm.
I know there are things I'm missing, things that embarrass you, and I have guesses. I'm not a fool, and yet I get frustrated with your flirtation and sarcasm, both behaviors where you apparently act opposite to what you feel. I fear that I will never understand you.
Susebron stared with frustration at his board, wiping cloth held in one hand, charcoal in the other.
I'm sorry.
Siri wrapped her arms around his elbow, laying her head against his upper arm.
I think you're doing better than you think. Most people back in my homeland didn't understand me half as well as you do. I find that hard to believe. It's true. They kept telling me to become someone else. Who? My sister. The woman you were supposed to marry. She was everything the daughter of a king should be. Controlled, soft-spoken, obedient, learned. She sounds boring. Vivenna is a wonderful person. She's always very kind to me. It's just that, well, I think even she felt that I should have been more reserved. I can't understand that. You're wonderful. So full of life and excitement. The priests and servants of the palace, they wear colors, but there's no color inside of them. They just go about their duties, eyes down, solemn. You've got color on the inside. So much of it that it bursts out and colors everything around you. That sounds like biochroma. You are more honest than biochroma. My breath, it makes things more bright. But it isn't mine. It was given to me. Yours is your own.
Siri felt her hair shift from the deep red into a golden tone. Siri pulled herself a little closer to him.
How do you do that? Do what? Change your hair. Oh, that one was unconscious. It goes blonde if I feel happy or content. You're happy then? With me? Of course. But when you speak of the mountains, there is such longing in your voice. I miss them, but if I left here, I'd miss you, too. Sometimes you can't have everything you want, since the wants contradict each other.
They fell silent for a time, and he set his board aside, hesitantly wrapping his arm around her and leaning back against the headboard. A blushful tinge of red crept into her hair as she realized that they were still sitting on the bed, and she was snuggling up beside him, wearing only her shift. The only thing that spoiled the moment was the occasional rumbling of her stomach.
You are hungry? No, my stomach is an anarchist. It growls like that when it's full. Sarcasm? Oh, a poor attempt. It's all right, I'll survive. Didn't you eat before you came to my chambers? Oh, I did, but growing that much hair is draining. It always leaves me hungry.
Huh?
It makes you hungry every night? And you didn't say anything?
Siri shrugged.
I will get you food. Oh, no, we can't afford to expose ourselves. Expose what? I am God King. I have food whenever I wish it. I have sent for it at night before. This will not be odd.
Susebron stood, walking toward the doorway.
Wait!
He turned, glancing back at her.
You can't go to the door like that, Sousa Braun. You're still fully dressed.
Sousa Braun looked down, then frowned. Oh,
make your clothes look disheveled, at least.
Ciri quickly hid his writing board. He undid his neck buttons, then threw off his deep black overrobe, revealing an undergarment. Like everything white near him, it gave off a halo of rainbow colors. He reached up, mussing his dark hair. He turned back to her, eyes questioning.
Good enough.
Ciri pulled the bedsheets up to her neck, covering herself. Sousa Braun commanded food by putting a hand to his stomach, then pointing away. The servants, barely visible to Ciri through the doorway, scuttled away at his order. A few minutes later, servants arrived at the room with a dining table and a chair. They set the table with large amounts of food, everything from roasted fish to pickled vegetables and simmering shellfish. Ciri watched with amazement. The servants set only one chair at the table. Ciri watched as they brought in plate after plate. They couldn't know what the God King wanted, so they apparently brought him some of everything. They filled the table, then retreated as Sousa Braun pointed for them to go. The scents were almost too much for Ciri in her hungered state. She threw off the sheets and rushed over. She had thought the meals prepared for her were extravagant, but they were nothing compared to this feast. Sousa Braun gestured toward the chair.
Aren't you going to eat?
Sousa Braun shrugged. Ciri walked over and took one of the blankets from the bed. Then she spread it on the stone floor.
What looks good to you?
Sousa Braun pointed at the plate of simmering mussels and several of the breads. She moved these, along with a dish that didn't appear to have any fish in it, a bowl of exotic fruits tossed in some kind of creamy sauce, to the cloth. She then sat down and began eating. Sousa Braun carefully situated himself on the floor. He managed to look dignified, even when wearing only his undergarment. Ciri reached over and handed him his board.
This is very odd. What, eating on the floor? Dining is such a production for me. I eat some of what is on a plate, then servants pull it away, wipe my face, and bring me another one. I never finish an entire dish, even if I like it. Oh, I'm surprised they don't hold the spoon for you. They did when I was younger. I eventually got them to let me do it myself. It's hard when you can't speak with anyone. I can imagine.
Ciri eyed Sousa Braun, who ate with small, reserved bites. She felt a slight stab of shame at how fast she was eating, then decided she didn't care. Ciri put aside the fruit dish and fetched several pastries from the table.
Oh, that's delicious.
Sousa Braun eyed her as she began to eat one after another.
Those are pan-kal tinkfans. One takes only small bites, making sure to eat a piece of bread in between to clear away the taste. Oh, they are a delicacy and...
Ciri smiled widely at Sousa Braun, mouthful of the so-called delicacy.
You realize that children in the stories who gorged themselves usually ended up being thrown off of cliffs?
Ciri stuffed another crisp bread into her mouth beside the first, dusting her fingers and face with powdered sugar in the process, her cheeks bulging. Sousa Braun watched her, then reached over and took a whole one himself. He inspected it, then shoved it into his mouth. Ciri nearly spit out bits of pastry onto the blanket.
And so, my corruption of the king continues. This is very curious.
Sousa Braun ate another crisp bread, then another, then another.
One would think that as God King, you would at least be able to eat sweets whenever you want. I have many rules that others need not follow. The stories explained this. Much is required of a prince or a king. I would rather have been born a peasant.
Ciri raised an eyebrow. She had a feeling that he'd be surprised if he actually had to experience things like hunger, poverty, or even discomfort. However, she left him his illusions. Who was she to chastise?
You are the one who was hungry, but I am doing all the eating. They obviously don't feed you enough.
Ciri tried a slice of bread. Sousa Braun shrugged, continuing to eat. She watched him, wondering if eating was different for him with no tongue. Did that affect his ability to taste? He certainly still seemed to like the sweets. Thinking of her tongue made her mind turn to darker topics.
We can't just keep going on like this, playing around at night, pretending like the world isn't going on without us. We're going to get crushed. Susabron, I think we need to find a way to expose what your priests have been doing to you. What do you mean? I mean that we should have you try to talk to the common people, or maybe some of the other gods. The priests gain all of their power by associating with you. If you choose to communicate through someone else, it would overthrow them. Do we need to do that? Pretend with me for a moment that we do. Very well. But how exactly would I communicate with someone else? I can't exactly stand up and begin shouting. I don't know. Notes, perhaps? There is a story about that in my book. A princess trapped in a tower who throws notes out into the ocean waters. The king of the fishes finds them. Oh, I doubt the king of the fishes cares about our predicament. Such a creature is only slightly less fantastic than the possibility of my notes being found and interpreted correctly. If I threw them out the window, nobody would believe that the God King had written them. And if you pass them to a servant, assuming that you're right, and that my priests are working against me, then wouldn't it be foolhardy to trust the servants they employ? Perhaps. We could try upon call, servant. None of them attend me, for I am the God King. Besides, what if we did get a servant or two on our side? How would that expose the priests? Nobody would believe a Pancal servant who contradicts the priests. Oh, I suppose you could try making a scene, running away or causing a distraction. When outside of the palace, I am constantly attended by a troop of hundreds, awakeners, soldiers, guards, priests, and lifeless warriors. Do you honestly think I could make any kind of scene without being rushed away before I could communicate with anyone? No, but we have to do something. There has to be a way out of this. I do not see one. Oh, we need to work with the priests, not against them. Perhaps they know more about why the God Kings die. They could tell us. I can speak to them, using the artisan script. No, not yet. Let me think first. Susabron, would you consider running away with me back to Idris? Perhaps. That seems extreme. What if I could prove to you that the priests are trying to kill you? And what if I could provide some way out? Someone to smuggle us from the palace and out of the city? If it is the only way, then I will go with you. But I do not believe that we will get to that point. I hope you're right. But if you're not, then we're escaping. We'll take our chances back with my family, war or no war.
In the slums, it could seem like night even during the full light of day. Vivenna wandered, aimless, stepping over soiled bits of colorful trash. She knew that she should find a place to hide and stay there, yet she wasn't really thinking straight anymore. Parlin was dead. He'd been her friend since childhood. She'd convinced him to come with her on what now seemed the most idiotic of quests. His death was her fault. Denth and his team had betrayed her. No, they had never worked for her. Now that she looked back, she could see the signs. How conveniently they'd found her in the restaurant. How they'd used her to get at Lemek's breath. How they'd manipulated her, letting her feel that she was in control. They'd just been playing along. She'd been a prisoner and never known it. The betrayal felt so much the worse for how she'd come to trust, even befriend them. She should have seen the warnings. Tonk Fa's joking brutality, Denth's explanations that mercenaries had no allegiances. He pointed out that jewels would work against her own gods. Compared to that, what was betraying a friend? Vivenna stumbled down yet another alleyway, hand on the wall of a brick building beside her. Dirt and soot stained her fingers. Her hair was a bleached white. It still hadn't recovered. The attack in the slum had been frightening. Getting captured by Vasher had been terrifying. But seeing Parlin tied to that chair, blood coming from his nose, his cheeks sliced open to reveal the inside of his mouth, she would never forget. Something inside of her seemed broken. Her ability to care. She was just numb. She reached the end of the alleyway, then looked up dully. There was a wall in front of her, a dead end. She turned to go back.
You!
Vivenna stood in a narrow alley like those she had walked down all day. She kept to the slums, figuring the Denth would expect her to run for the open city. He knew it better than she did. A man sat on a small stack of boxes in behind of her, legs swinging over the sides. He was short, dark-haired, and wore typical slum clothing, a mixture of garments going through various stages of wear.
You've been causing quite a stir. Woman wandering the slums in a beautiful white dress. Eyes dark, hair white and ragged. If everyone hadn't been so paranoid following the raid the other day, you'd have been seen 2 hours ago.
You're Adrian. You were there in the crowd when I visited the slumlords.
The man shrugged.
That means you know who I am.
Oh, I don't know anything. Particularly not things that could get me into trouble.
Please, you have to help me.
The man hopped off his boxes, a knife flashing in his hand.
Help you? I saw that look in your eyes when you came to the meetings. You look down on us, just like the Halandrin. A lot of people have seen you wandering about like a wraith, but nobody seems to know exactly where to find you. There's a search going on in some parts. I figure that someone will find you eventually. So I'm gonna act first.
Please.
The man raised the knife.
I won't turn you in. You deserve at least that much, don't you think? Besides, I don't want to draw attention to myself. That dress, though, that will sell for a lot, even damaged like it is. I could feed my family for weeks on that cloth.
What?
You scream and I'll cut you. It's not a threat, it's an inevitability. The dress, princess, you'll be better without it. It's what's making everyone take notice of you.
Vivenna considered using her breath, but what if it didn't work? She couldn't concentrate and had a feeling that she wouldn't be able to get the commands to work. She wavered, but the looming knife convinced her. So, staring straight ahead and feeling like she was someone else, she reached up and began undoing the buttons.
Don't you drop it on the ground. It's dirty enough already.
Vivenna pulled off the dress, standing only in her underleggings and her shift. He took the dress, then opened her pocket pouch. He frowned as he tossed aside the rope inside of it.
No money?
No.
Well, the leggings, they're silk, right?
Vivenna's shift came down to her mid-thighs. She stooped down, pulling off the leggings, then handed them over. He took them, and she saw a glint of greed, or perhaps something else in his eyes.
The shift.
No.
The man took a step forward.
No! No, no, no! You take your city, your colors, and your clothing, and go! Leave me!
Vivenna fell to her knees and grabbed handfuls of refuse and mud, rubbing it on the shift.
There! You want it? Take it from me! Sell it like this!
Contrary to his threat, the man wavered. He looked around, then clutched the valuable cloth to his chest and dashed away. The Vivenna knelt. Where had she found more tears? She curled up, heedless of the trash and mud, and wept. It started raining sometime while she was curled in the mud. It was one of the soft, hazy Halandrin rainfalls. The wet drops kissed her cheek. Little streams ran down the sides of the alleyway walls. Vivenna was hungry and exhausted. But with the falling rain came a shred of lucidity. She needed to move. The thief had been right. The dress had been a hindrance. She felt naked in the shift, particularly now that it was wet, but she had seen women in the slums wearing just as little. She needed to go on, become just another waif in the dirt and grime. She crawled over to a refuse pile, noticing a bit of a cloth sticking from it. She pulled free a muddy, stinking shawl. Or maybe it had been a rug. Either way, she wrapped it around her shoulders, pulling it tight across her chest to offer some measure of modesty. She tried to make her hair black, but it refused. She sat down, too apathetic to be frustrated. Instead, she simply rubbed mud and dirt into her hair, changing the pale white into a sickly brown. Vivenna began to make her way out of the alleyway, then paused. The shawl had become brighter now that she was wearing it.
Breath. I'll be immediately visible to anyone with the first tightening. I can't hide in the slums.
Vivenna still felt the loss of the breath she'd sent into the rope, and then the larger amount she'd wasted on Tonk's cloak. Yet, she had greater portion left. She huddled down by the side of the wall, nearly losing control again as she considered the situation. And then she realized something.
Tonk Fa snuck up on me down in that cellar. I couldn't feel his breath, just like I couldn't feel Vasher's when he ambushed me in my rooms.
The answer felt so easy it was ridiculous. She couldn't feel the breath in the rope she'd made. She picked it up, tying it around her ankle. Then she took the shawl, holding it in front of her. It was such a pathetic thing, frayed at the edges, its original red color barely peeking through the grime.
My breath to yours.
They were the same words Lennox had spoken when he'd given her his breath. It worked on the shawl, too. Her breath drained from her body, all of it, invested into the shawl. It was no command. The shawl wouldn't be able to do anything. But her breath, hopefully, would be safe. She wouldn't give off an aura. None at all. Vivenna almost fell to the ground with the shock of losing it all. Where she had once been able to sense the city around her, now everything became still. It was as if it had been silenced, the entire city becoming dead. Or maybe it was Vivenna who had become dead and drab. She stood slowly and wiped the water from her eyes. Then she pulled the shawl, breaths and all, close, and shuffled away. Lightsong sat on the edge of his bed, sweat thick on his brow as he stared down at the floor in front of him. Larimar eyed a lesser scribe who lowered his pen. Servants clustered around the edges of the bedchamber. They had, at his request, woken him unusually early in the morning.
Your Grace!
It's nothing. I dream of war because I'm thinking about it. Not because of prophecy. Not because I'm a god.
It felt so real. In the dream, he had been a man on the battlefield with no weapon. Soldiers had died around him, friend after friend. He had known them, each one close to him.
A war against Idris wouldn't be like that. It would be fought by our lifeless.
Lightsong didn't want to acknowledge that his friends during the dream hadn't been wearing bright colors. He hadn't been seeing through the eyes of a Halandran soldier, but an Idrian. Perhaps that was why it had been such a slaughter.
The Idrians are the ones threatening us. They're the rebels who broke off, maintaining a second throne inside of Halandran borders. They need to be quelled. They deserve it.
What did you see, Your Grace?
Lightsong closed his eyes. There are other images. The recurring ones. The glowing red panther, the tempest. A young woman's face being absorbed by darkness. Eaten alive.
I saw Blushweaver. Her face red and flushed. I saw you, and you were sleeping. And I saw the God King.
The God King?
He was crying.
The scribe wrote the images down. Larimar, for once, didn't prompt further. Lightsong stood, forcing the images out of his mind. Yet he couldn't ignore that his body felt weak. It was feast day, and he would have to take in a breath, or he would die.
I'm going to need some urns. 2 dozen of them, one for each of the gods, painted after their colors. I'll also need some pebbles. Lots of them.
Larimar nodded. Once Lightsong was dressed, he turned to leave the room. Off once again to feed on the soul of a child. Lightsong threw a pebble into one of the urns in front of him.
Well done, Your Grace.
Larimar stood beside Lightsong's chair.
Nothing to it.
Lightsong tossed another pebble. It fell short of the intended urn, and a servant rushed forward, plucking it off the ground and depositing it in the proper container.
I appear to be a natural. I get it in every time.
Indeed, Your Grace. I believe that Her Grace the Goddess Blushweaver is approaching.
Good. I can show off my pebble-throwing skills.
Lightsong sat on the green of the courtyard, a cool breeze blowing. His pavilion set up just inside the court's gates. He could see the blocking wall, the one that kept him from looking out at the city proper. With the wall in the way, it was a rather depressing sight.
If they're going to lock us in here, they could at least give us the courtesy of a decent view out.
What in the name of the iridescent tones are you doing?
Lightsong didn't need to look to know that Blushweaver was standing with hands on hips beside him. He threw another pebble.
You know, it's always struck me as strange. When we say oaths like that, we use the colors. Why not use our own names? We are allegedly gods.
Most gods don't like their names being used as an oath.
Then they are far too pompous for my taste. I personally should find it very flattering to have my name used as an oath. Lightsong the Brave, or By Lightsong the Brave. I suppose that's a bit of a mouthful. Perhaps we could shorten it to simple Lightsong.
I swear, you are getting stranger by the day.
No, actually, you didn't swear in that particular statement. Unless you're proposing we should swear using the personal pronoun, you! So, your line at this point is, what in the name of you are you doing?
Oh, hell. I've wasted my morning coming to speak to a fool.
I certainly don't deserve that yet. I've barely gotten started. Something else must be bothering you.
All Mother.
Still won't give you the commands.
Refuses to even speak with me now.
Ah, if only she knew the refreshing sense of frustration she was missing out on knowing by refusing your acquaintance.
I'm not that frustrating. I've actually been rather charming with her.
Then that is your problem, I surmise. We're gods, my dear, and we quickly grow tired of our immortal existences. Surely we seek for extreme ranges in emotion, good or bad, it doesn't matter. In a way, it's the absolute value of emotion that is important, rather than the positive or negative nature of that emotion.
Lightsong, dear, what in the name of you did that mean?
I'm not exactly sure. It just kind of came out. I can visualize what it means in my head, though, with numbers.
Are you all right?
Images of warfare flashed in his mind. His best friend, a man he didn't know, dying with a sword through his chest.
I'm not sure. Things have been rather strange for me lately.
You want to go back to my palace and frolic? That always makes me feel better.
You, my dear, are incorrigible.
I'm the goddess of lust. For your sake, I've got to fill the role.
Last I checked, you were the goddess of honesty.
Honesty and honest emotions, my dear. And let me tell you, lust is one of the most honest of all emotions. Now, what are you doing with those silly pebbles?
Counting.
Counting your inanities?
That. And counting the number of priests who come through the gates, wearing the colors of each god or goddess.
Blushweaver frowned. It was midday and the gates were fairly busy with the comings and goings of servants and performers. There were only occasionally priests or priestesses, however, since they would have been required to come in early to attend their gods.
Each time a priest of a particular god enters, I toss a pebble into the urn representing that god.
I'm baffled.
Well, it's easy. You see someone wearing purple, you throw a pebble in the urn of the same color.
Yes, dear, but why?
To keep track of how many priests of each god enter the court, of course. They've slowed to nearly a trickle. Scoot, would you mind counting?
Larimar bowed, then gathered several servants and scribes, ordering them to empty the urns and count the contents of each one.
My dear Lightsong, I do apologize if I've been ignoring you lately. Allmother has been rudely unresponsive to my suggestions. If my lack of attention has caused your fragile mind to snap...
My mind is quite unsnapped, thank you.
Then you must be so very bored. Perhaps we can come up with something to entertain you?
I'm well entertained.
Lightsong smiled even before the counting results were in. Mercy Star had one of the smallest piles.
Lightsong.
I ordered my priests in early today. and a set-up position here in front of the gates before the sun even rose. We've been counting priests for some 6 hours now.
Larimar walked over, handing Lightsong a list of the gods and the number of priests who had entered wearing their colors.
Mm-hmm. Some of the gods have had over 100 priests report for service. Yet a couple of them have had barely a dozen. Mercy Star is one of those.
So,
I'm going to send my servants to watch and count at Mercy Star's palace, keeping track of the number of priests who are there. I already suspect that I know what they'll find. Mercy Star doesn't have fewer priests than the rest of us. They're just getting into the court by a different route.
Blushweaver looked at him blankly, but then cocked her head.
The tunnels?
Lightsong nodded.
Well, at least you're not insane. Or bored. You're just obsessed.
Something is going on with those tunnels, Blushweaver. And it relates to the servant who was murdered.
Lightsong, we have much bigger problems to worry about. I can't believe that you're still bothering with this. Honestly, the kingdom is about to go to war for the first time. Your position in the assembly is important, and you're worrying about how priests are getting into the court?
Here, let me prove my point to you.
Lightsong reached over to the side of his couch and picked a small box up off the ground. He held it up, showing it to Blushweaver.
A box. What a convincing argument you make.
Lightsong pulled the top off of the box, leaving a small gray squirrel sitting in his hand. It stood perfectly still, staring forward, fur blowing in the breeze.
A lifeless rodent. Oh, that's much better. I feel myself being swayed already.
The person who broke into Mercy Star's palace used this as a distraction. Do you know anything about breaking lifeless, my dear?
Blushweaver shrugged.
I did neither. Not until I required my priests to break this one. Apparently, it requires weeks to take control of a lifeless for which you do not have the right security phrases. I'm not even sure how the process goes. It has something to do with breath. And torture, apparently.
Torture? A lifeless can't feel.
Lightsong shrugged.
Anyway, my servants broke this one for me. The stronger and more skilled the Awakener who created the lifeless, the more difficult it is to break it.
That's why we need to get the commands from Allmother. If something were to happen to her, her 10,000 would become useless to us. It would take years to break that many lifeless.
But the God King and some of her priestesses have the codes as well.
Oh, and you think he is going to just give them over to us? Assuming we're even allowed to talk to him.
I'm just pointing out that a single assassination couldn't ruin our entire army. That's not the point. The point is that whomever made this squirrel held quite a bit of breath and knew what he was doing. The creature's blood has been replaced with ichor alcohol. The sutures are perfect. The commands controlling the rodent were extremely strong. It's a marvelous piece of biochromatic art.
And
he released it in Mercy Star's palace, creating a distraction so that he could sneak into those tunnels. Someone else followed the intruder, and this second person killed a man to keep him from revealing what he'd seen. Whatever is in those tunnels, wherever they lead, it's important enough to waste breath on, important enough to kill for.
Oh, I still can't believe you're even worrying about this.
Well, you said you knew about the tunnels. I had Larimar ask around, and others know of them too. They're used for storage beneath the palaces, as said. Different gods have ordered them constructed at various times during the history of the court. But they would also be the perfect place to set up a clandestine operation. The court is outside the jurisdiction of the regular city guards. Each palace is like a little autonomous country. Expand a few of those cellars so that their tunnels connect with others. Dig them out past the walls so you can come and go secretly.
Lightsong, if something that secret were going on, then why would the priests use those tunnels to come into the court? Wouldn't that be a little suspicious? I mean, if you noticed it, how hard could it be to discover?
Of course, I got so wrapped up in pretending to be useful that I forgot myself. Thank you so much for reminding me that I am an idiot.
Oh, Lightsong, I didn't mean
that. No, it's quite all right. Why bother? I need to remember who I am. Lightsong, self-hating god, the most useless person ever granted immortality. Just answer one question for me.
What question?
Why? Why do I hate being a god? Why do I act so frivolous? Why do I undermine my own authority?
Why?
I always assumed it was because you were amused by the contrast.
No, Blushweaver, I was like this from the very first day. When I awoke, I refused to believe I was a god. Refused to accept my place in this pantheon, in this court. I've acted accordingly ever since. And if I may say, I've gotten quite a bit more clever about it as the years have passed. Which is beside the point. The thing I must focus on, the important point here, is why.
I don't know.
I don't either. But whomever I was before, he's trying to get out. He keeps whispering for me to dig at this mystery. He keeps warning me that I'm no god. He keeps prompting me to deal with all this in a frivolous way. I don't know who I was. Nobody will tell me. But I'm beginning to have suspicions. I was a person who couldn't simply sit and let something unexplained slide away into the fog of memory. I was a man who hated secrets. And I'm only just beginning to understand how many secrets there are in this court.
Blushweaver looked taken aback.
Now, if you will excuse me, I have some business to attend to.
What business?
To see Allmother. There are some lifeless commands that need to be dealt with.
A week living in the gutters served to drastically change Vivenna's perspective on life. She sold her hair on the second day for a depressingly small amount of money. The food that she'd bought hadn't even filled her stomach, and she didn't have the strength to regrow the locks. The haircut didn't even have the dignity of being cleanly shorn. It was a ragged job of hackwork, and the remaining hair would have still been a pale white, save for the fact that it was matted and blackened with dirt and soot. She'd thought about selling her breath, but wouldn't even know where to go or how to go about it. Besides, she had a strong feeling that Denth would be watching places where she might sell the breath. Beyond that, she had no idea how to get the breaths back from her shawl now that she'd put them into it. No, she had to remain secret, unseen. Couldn't draw attention to herself. She sat on the side of the street, holding out her hand to the passing crowds, keeping her eyes down. No offerings came. She wasn't certain how the other beggars did it. Their meager earnings seemed an amazing treasure. They knew so much she didn't. Where to sit, how to plead. Passers learned to avoid beggars even with their eyes. The successful beggars, then, were those who managed to draw attention. Vivenna wasn't certain if she wanted the attention or not. Though the gnawing pain of hunger had eventually driven her out onto busy streets, she was still frightened that Denth or Vasha might find her. The more hungry she got, the less other worries bothered her. Eating was a problem for now. Being killed by Denth or Vasha was a problem for later. The flood of people in their colors continued to pass. Vivenna watched them without focusing on faces or bodies, just colors. Like a spinning wheel, each spoke a different hue.
Denth won't find me here. He won't see the princess and the beggar on the side of the street.
She was learning to ignore the pain of hunger, just like the people ignored her. She didn't feel like she was a true beggar or child of the street, not after just 1 week. But she was learning to imitate them. And her mind felt so fuzzy lately, ever since she'd gotten rid of her breath. She pulled the shawl close. She kept it with her always. Vivenna still hardly believed what Denth and the others had done. She had such fond memories of their joking. She couldn't connect that to what she'd seen in the cellar. In fact, sometimes she found herself rising to seek them out. Surely the things she'd seen had been hallucinations. Surely they couldn't be such terrible men.
That's foolish. I need to focus. Why isn't my mind working right anymore?
Focus on what? There wasn't much to think about. She couldn't go to Denth. Parlin was dead. The city authorities would be no help. She had now heard the rumors of the Idrian princess who had been causing such troubles. She'd be arrested in a heartbeat. If there were any more of her father's agents in the city, she had no idea how to locate them without exposing herself to Denth. Besides, there was a good chance that Denth had found those agents and killed them. He'd been so clever at keeping her captive, quietly eliminating those who could have taken her to safety. What did her father think? Vivenna lost to him, every man he sent to retrieve her vanishing mysteriously, Alandrin inching closer and closer to declaring war. Those were distant worries. There were soup kitchens in the city, but at the first one she'd gone to, she'd spotted Tong Fa lounging in a doorway across the street. She turned and scurried away, hoping he hadn't seen her. For the same reason, she didn't dare leave the city. Denth was sure to have agents watching the gates. Besides, where would she go? She didn't have the supplies for a trip back to Idris. Perhaps she could leave if she managed to save up enough money. That was hard, almost impossible. Every time she got a coin, she spent it on food. She couldn't help herself. Nothing else seemed to matter. She'd already lost weight. So she sat, sweaty and filthy in the meager shade. She still wore only her shift and the shawl, though she was dirty enough that it was difficult to tell where clothing ended and skin began. Her former arrogant refusal to wear anything but the elegant dresses now seemed ridiculous. She shook her head, trying to clear the fog from it. 1 week on the street felt like an eternity. Yet she knew that she'd only just begun to experience the life of the poor. How did they survive? Sleeping in alleyways, getting rained on every day, jumping at every sound, feeling so hungry they were tempted to pick at and eat the rotting garbage they found in gutters. She'd tried that. She'd even managed to keep some down. It was the only thing she had to eat in 2 days. Someone stopped beside her. She looked up, eager, hands stretching out further until she saw the colors he wore. Yellow and blue. City guard. She grabbed at her shawl, pulling it closer. It was foolish, she knew. Nobody knew about the breaths it contained. The move was reflexive. The shawl was the only thing she owned, and, meager though it was, several urchins had already tried to steal it from her while she slept. The guard didn't reach for her shawl. He just nudged her with his truncheon.
Hey, move! No begging on this corner!
Vivenna rose and felt a moment of nausea and dizziness. She rested against the side of the building, and the guard nudged her again.
Go on, then!
Vivenna bowed her head and moved along with the crowd, though most of them kept their distance from her. Ironic that they would leave her space now that she didn't care. She didn't want to think about how she smelled, though more than the scent, it was the fear of being robbed that probably kept the others away. They needn't have worried. She wasn't skilled enough to cut purses or pick pockets, and she couldn't afford to get caught trying. She'd stopped worrying about the morality of stealing days ago. Even before leaving the slum alleys for the streets, she hadn't been so naive as to believe that she wouldn't steal if she were denied food, though she had assumed that it would take her far longer to reach that state. She didn't head to another corner, but instead shuffled out of the crowds, making her way back into the Idrian slums. Here she'd gained some small measure of acceptance. At least she was considered one of them. None knew that she was the princess. After that first man, nobody had recognized her. However, her accent had earned her a place. She began to seek out a location to spend the night. That was one of the reasons she'd decided not to continue begging for the evening. It was a profitable time, true, but she was just so tired. She wanted a good place to sleep. She wouldn't have thought that it would make much difference which alleyway one huddled in, but some were warmer than others, and some had better cover from the rain. Some were safer. She was beginning to learn these things, as well as who to avoid angering. In her case, that last group included pretty much everyone, including the urchins. They were all above her in the pecking order. She'd learned that the second day. She'd tried to bring back a coin from selling her hair, intending to save it for a chance at leaving the city. She wasn't certain how the urchins had known that she had a coin, but she'd gotten her first beating that day. Her favorite alleyway turned out to be occupied by a group of men with dark expressions, doing something that was obviously illegal. She left quickly, going to her second favorite. It was crowded with a gang of urchins, the ones who had beaten her before. She left that one quickly as well. The third alley was empty. This one was beside a building with a bakery. The ovens hadn't yet been stoked for the night's baking, but they would provide some warmth through the walls in the early morning. Vivenna laid down, curling up with her back against the bricks, clutching her shawl close. Despite the lack of pillow or blanket, she was asleep in moments. Ciri was enjoying a meal on the court green when Trilides found her. She ignored him, content to pick at the dishes in front of her. The sea, she had decided, was quite strange. What else could be said of a place that could spawn creatures with such wiggly tentacles and boneless bodies, and yet others with such needly skins? She poked at something the locals called a cucumber, but which, in actuality, tasted nothing like one. The God King's high priest was not one accustomed to waiting. Ciri nodded to her serving women, motioning for them to prepare another series of plates. Suzebron had been coaching Ciri on how to eat with etiquette, and she wanted to practice. Coincidentally, his way of eating, taking small bites, never really finishing anything, was a good one for testing out new dishes. She wanted to become familiar with Halandrin, its ways, its people, its tastes. She'd forced her servants to begin talking to her more, and she planned to meet with more of the gods. In the distance, she saw Lightsong wandering by, and she waved to him fondly. He seemed uncharacteristically preoccupied. He waved back, but didn't come over to visit her.
Pity. I would have liked a good excuse to keep Trilides waiting even longer.
Finally, Ciri stood, gesturing for her servants to stay behind.
Would you mind walking with me for a bit, Your Excellency?
Ciri passed him, moving languidly in a gorgeous velvet dress with a gossamer train that trailed through the grass behind her.
I need to speak to you about something.
Yes, I deduced that by the way you summoned me several times today.
You didn't come.
It seems to me that the consort of the God King should not make a habit of responding to demands and hopping to attend upon others whenever she is requested.
Trilides frowned.
However, I will of course make time for the High Priest himself, should he come to speak with me.
Trilides eyed her, standing tall and straight-backed, wearing the God King's colors of the day, blue and copper.
You should not antagonize me, Your Highness.
I am not antagonizing you. I am simply establishing some rules that should have been understood from the beginning.
Trilides got a hint of a smile on his face.
What? Why that reaction?
Is that so? You know very little of what you presume, Your Highness.
I might say the same to you, Your Excellency.
Oh? Somehow I doubt that.
Ciri had to force back a spear of anxiety. Trilides smiled again.
Wait. It's like he can read my emotions. Like he can see.
Ciri's hair hadn't changed colors, at least not discernibly. She glanced at Trilides, trying to figure out what was wrong. She noticed something interesting. In a circle around Trilides, the grass seemed just a shade more colorful.
Breath! Of course he'd have it! He's one of the most powerful men in the kingdom!
People with lots of breath were supposed to be able to see very minute changes in color. Could he really be reading her from such faint reactions in her hair? Was that why he had always been so dismissive? Could he see her fear? She gritted her teeth. In her youth, Ciri had ignored the exercises that Vivenna had done to make sure she had complete control of her hair. Ciri was an emotional person, and people had been able to read her regardless her hair, so she'd figured that there was no point in learning to manipulate the royal locks. She hadn't imagined a court of the gods, and men with the power of biochroma. Those tutors had been a whole lot more intelligent than Ciri had credited, as were the priests. Now that she thought about it, it was obvious that Trilides and the others would have studied the meanings of all the shades of hair changes.
Do not forget, Trilides. You are the one who came to see me. Obviously, I have some power here, if I could force even the High Priest to do as I wish.
Trilides glanced at her, eyes cold. Focusing, she kept her hair the deepest black. Black for confidence. She met his eyes and let not even a slight tinge color her locks.
I have heard disturbing rumors.
Oh?
Yes. It appears that you are no longer fulfilling your wifely duties. Are you pregnant?
No. I had my women's issue just a couple of days ago. You can ask my servants.
Then why have you stopped trying?
What? Are your spies disappointed to be missing their nightly show?
Trilides glanced at her, and she still managed to keep her hair perfectly black. Not even a glimmer of white or red. He seemed more uncertain.
Ugh, you Edrians, living up in your lofty mountains, dirty and uncultured, but still assuming that you're better than us. Don't judge me. Don't judge us. You know nothing.
I know that you've been listening in on the God King's chamber.
Oh, not just listening. The first few nights, there was a spy on the chambers itself.
Ciri couldn't mask this blush. Her hair remained mostly black, but if Trelides really did have enough biochroma to distinguish subtle changes, he would have seen a hint of red.
I am well aware of the poisonous things your monks teach, the hatred into which you're indoctrinated. Do you really think that we'd let a woman from Idris confront the God King himself, alone, unwatched? We had to make certain you weren't intending to kill him. We're still not convinced.
You speak with remarkable frankness.
Merely saying some things that I should have established from the beginning. You are not important here, not compared to our God King. He is everything, and you are nothing. Just like the rest of us.
Ciri held his eyes. The woman she'd been a few months ago would have looked away, but when she felt weak, she remembered Suzebron. Trelides was orchestrating the plot to subdue, control, and eventually kill his own God King. And Ciri wanted to know why.
I stopped having sex with the God King on purpose. I knew it would get your attention.
In truth, she had simply stopped her little performances each night. Trelides' reaction, fortunately, proved that the priests believed her acting. For that, she blessed her luck. They might still be unaware that she could communicate with Suzebron. She was extra careful to whisper at night, and had even taken to writing things herself to keep up the charade.
You must produce an heir.
Or what? Why are you so eager, Trelides?
It is none of your concern. Suffice it to say that I have obligations that you cannot comprehend. I am subject to the gods, and I do their will, not yours.
Well, you're going to have to bend on that last part, if you want an heir.
Trelides obviously did not like how the conversation was going. He glanced at her hair, and, somehow, she kept it from showing even a slight bit of uncertainty. He looked back at her eyes.
You can't kill me, Trelides. Not if you want a royal heir. You can't bully me or force me. Only the God King could do that. And we know how he is.
I don't know what you mean.
Oh, come now. Did you honestly expect me to sleep with a man and not find out he has no tongue? That he's virtually a child? I doubt he can even go to the privy without help from some servants. He really does care. Or, at least, insulting his God King insults him. He's more devoted than I would have expected.
So it probably wasn't about money. She couldn't be sure, but she suspected that this was not the type of man to sell out his religion. Whatever the reasons for what was happening inside the palace, it probably had to do with true conviction. Revealing what she knew about Suzebron was a gamble. She figured that Trelides would guess anyway, and so it would be better to indicate that she thought Suzebron a fool with the mind of a child. Give away one bit of information, but also mislead with another. If they assumed that she thought Suzebron a fool, they wouldn't suspect conspiracy between her and her husband. Ciri wasn't certain if she was doing the right thing, but she needed to learn or Suzebron would die. And the only way to learn was to do. She didn't have much, but she did have one thing that the priests wanted, her womb. It seemed that she could hold it for ransom effectively, for Trelides suppressed his anger and maintained a semblance of calm. Turning from her, he glanced up at the palace.
Do you know much about the history of this kingdom? After your family departed, of course.
Not really.
Lord Peacegiver left us with a challenge. He gave us the treasure our God King now holds. A wealth of biochromatic breath such as nobody had ever seen. Over 50,000 breaths. He told us to keep them safe. And he warned us not to use it. I do not expect you to understand what we have done. But it was necessary.
Necessary to keep a man in bondage? To deprive him of the ability to speak? To make a permanent child out of a grown man? He didn't even understand what he was supposed to do with a woman.
It was necessary. You Idrians, you don't even try to understand. I've had dealings with your father for years, and I sense the same ignorant prejudice in him.
Believing in Austria instead of your living gods is not ignorance. After all, you're the ones who abandoned our faith and took an easier path.
We follow the god who came to protect us when your Austri, an unseen, unknown thing, abandoned us to the destroyer Kalad. Peacegiver returned to life with a specific purpose. to stop the conflict between men, to bring peace again to Halandrin. His name is Holy. He is the one who gave us life, Princess. And he only asked one thing of us, to care for his power. He died to give it to us, but demanded that it be held in case he should return again and need it. We couldn't let it be used. We couldn't let it be profaned. Not even by our God King.
I see now why your father sent you instead of the other one. We should have studied all of the daughters, not just the first. You are far more capable than we had been led to believe. What are your demands? What will it take to make you return to your duties each night?
My servants. I want to replace my main serving women with the women from Pankal.
You are displeased with your serving women?
Not particularly. I simply feel that I have more in common with the women of Pankal. They, like me, are living in exile from their own people. Besides, I like the browns they wear.
Of course.
The Halandrin girls can continue to serve in the roles that the Pankal women did. They don't have to leave me completely. In fact, I still want to talk to some of them. However, the main women who are with me always, they are to be from Pankal.
As I said, it shall be done. You'll return to your efforts, then?
For now. That will earn you a few more weeks.
Trelides frowned, but what could he really do? Ciri smiled at him, then turned and walked away. However, she found herself dissatisfied with the way the conversation had gone. She'd achieved a victory, but at the cost of antagonizing Trelides even further.
I doubt he would have taken a liking to me, no matter how hard I tried. This is probably the better way.
Ciri still didn't know what was going to happen to Suzebron. At least, she had confirmed that manipulating the priests was possible. That meant something, though she knew she was treading dangerous ground. She did her best to learn about Halandrin, but if it came down to Suzebron's life, she was going to get him out. She hoped that giving Bluefinger's Pankal a more prominent role in her service would facilitate that escape. She hoped.